For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On a couple of previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of talking baseball with Galen White, who was a sports writer for the Oklahoma Journal, the Arizona Republic, and the Denver Post, and has given the world several really interesting baseball books. I think the first time we spoke was about his book, Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. We also talked about his book, Left on Base, in the Bush Leagues. We are talking today about his most recent book, which is called The Best Little Baseball Town in the World, The Crawley Millers and Minor League Baseball in the 1950s. The title says most of what you need to know about this book at the outset. It is about that special tier of professional baseball that we sometimes don't pay enough attention to. Namely minor league baseball, and particularly back in that really interesting era. And the minor league baseball activity in Crawley, Louisiana was especially exciting, and that town really cherished its baseball tradition and the success of its team. And Galen White has done an amazing job of evoking that era and of the exciting baseball that was played in Crawley, Louisiana back then. This book, as is the case with Mr. White's other baseball books, is published by Roman and Littlefield, again titled The Best Little Baseball Town in the World. And Galen H. White, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Always good to visit with you.
I'm very, very happy to be reconnecting with you and to talk with you about your most recent book. I wonder if you could remind me, I'm sure I asked you this in at least one of our previous conversations, about your own love of baseball and what prompted that. I mean, have you been a baseball fan nearly from the womb, or at some point did this game become really important to you?
You could probably take it back to the womb. I was born in 1946, and I vividly remember baseball games with my father at Wrigley Field in Los Angeles in 51, 52. That would make me 5 and 6 years old. I remember a shortstop that the Angels had named Gene Baker, and he wound up in the majors with the Cubs, and he was part of the first all-black double play combination, Ernie Banks and Gene Baker. So Gene Baker was one of those players who had quite an impact on me. There were others, Steve Bilko, who I write about in the Bilko Athletic Club. But it was growing up in Los Angeles, then a minor league town, going to Wrigley Field, which was the same as the Wrigley Field in Chicago, and keeping score with my father. He'd buy a newspaper going into the ballpark. That was the cheapest form of a program, and then we'd keep score. My older brother usually was out in the bleachers getting souvenir baseballs. We never had to buy one. He got so many of them out there. So it just was part of my upbringing, and my fondest memories are going to the ballpark with my father.
Hmm. Did you end up playing baseball at all, or were you content to be a spectator and to take it in from the stands?
I had a polio when I was 2 years old, Greg, and so I had atrophy in the right arm. That made me a left-hander, by the way. Hmm. But I like to tell people I found out fairly early in life that I could turn a phrase better than I could a double play.
So I believe it's in the foreword that this book is described as a wonderful examination of the lower minors. The lower minors. Can you explain what that term means?
Well, at that time, Crowley did not have a professional baseball team until 1950. The ballpark they built in 1948, hoping to get a minor league team. In 1949, that was the apex of the minors. There were 59 leagues, 447 teams. There were classifications all the way from AAA down through Class D. Crowley was a Class C team. The first year in 1950, they were a part of a new league, the Gulf Coast League. The next year, 1951, they moved over to the Evangeline League. And the Evangeline League, its history goes all the way back to 1934, made up mostly of Louisiana teams. Thus, the nickname for the league was the Tabasco League, sometimes called the Pepper Pot League. But it was a league that had a little bit of everything. They produced, prior to the war, some great major league players, pitchers such as Hal Newhouser, a Hall of Famer, Virgil Firetrucks, who won 177 games in the majors, Pete Reiser, who won the batting title in 1941 for the Dodgers, best known probably for running into the wall that ended his career. So they produced, prior to the war, a lot of great players. In 1946, right after the war, the first season after the Evangeline League returned, there was a game-fixing scandal. It was called the Little Black Sox scandal, and that was several players were suspended, five actually, for fixing games in the playoffs. It goes on from there. The league just was a fascinating league that I had heard about, but didn't know much about until I started doing research in the book.
So just so we understand kind of this hierarchy of minor league baseball as it was organized back then in that era, if you have these different levels all the way down to C and D, what is that gradation really about? Are we talking about the level of play, the quality of the players, the size of the teams, the amount of money in their budgets, or the size of their stadiums? I mean, what differentiated these various levels of minor league play?
It was based on a town's population.
Ah.
So as simple as that. So you had Crowley population, 12,700 at the time. The Class D leagues would probably be slightly smaller, but it was based on population. The players, you know, there was an abundance of players at one time or another. Now, right after the war, the minors were flooded, and that, of course, is when, in 1949, you had all those 447 teams. And then the Korean War came along, and that affected the supply. A lot of the younger players were drafted and had to serve in the Korean War. So that then opened the door for a lot of Cubans coming to the U.S. and filling that void left by the players involved in the Korean War. The leagues also had, so that no team could get stacked, they had had to use a certain number of rookies, and then they had limited service players, and then they had veterans. The number of veterans was usually limited to two or three. Limited service would be like four or five, and limited service would be where you had two or three years of experience, and rookies were kids fresh out of high school.
So in other words, it was organized in such a way that each of these teams would be a mix of promising,
yes,
players that were green and maybe grizzled veterans kind of in the twilight of their careers, and a few players somewhere in between. We think, of course, nowadays of minor league baseball often in terms of their connection to major league baseball and major league teams as kind of a system by which gifted players learn the game and then are eventually brought up the ranks and into major league. Is this how minor league baseball functioned back in this era? I mean, or sometimes, but not in every case?
A good number of your minor league teams were affiliated with the big leagues. But in the case of Crowley, in their 8 years of existence, 1950 was their first year, and then 57 was their last. It was only the last 2 years, 56 and 57, that they had an affiliation with a major league team, and that was the Kansas City Athletics. And that's why in the last 2 years they produced some guys who went on to play in the majors, but in the previous years none of them went on up to the majors. They were an independent team. The Crowley team was owned by the community. Everybody, you know, regular people paid $40 for stock, and it had close to 500 owners. The trades and everything that the club did were by its board of directors, which were lawyers, rice farmers, merchants. And what's amazing is the success that they had operating this way. They won the pennant their first year in the Gulf Coast League in 1950. In 1951, they were in first place when tragedy struck. Center fielder Andy Strong was playing in center field in Alexandria, Louisiana, and struck by lightning during a game. And, of course, that had a devastating effect on the team. They wound up in fifth place that year. Then the next 2 years, 52-53, they won the Evangel League pennant. And they were competitive throughout their history. And so that's why being a community-owned team and the pride that the town had in the team and the players loved Crowley. Crowley is known for being the rice capital of America. The players referred to it as the nice capital of America.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Galen H. White, and we're talking about his book called The Best Little Baseball Town in the World, The Crawley Millers and Minor League Baseball in the 1950s. This is a look at an exceptionally successful minor league team based in Crawley, Louisiana, in the 1950s. And, of course, it is a very, very different era in baseball. Mr. White, how did you first find out about the Crawley Millers? I mean, I'm not particularly surprised given your encyclopedic knowledge of baseball and its history, but do you happen to recall when you first became aware of the Crawley Millers, or maybe became aware that this would be a story sufficiently rich to merit this kind of focus and attention?
I vividly recall when it happened. It was near the end of 2012. I was interviewing a pitcher named Hugh Blanton. He had pitched for the Crawley Millers in 1952, winning 21 games. But my reason for interviewing Hugh was another ballplayer who I wrote about in Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Al Pinkston, who won six minor league batting titles, and which is tied for the most in history. And so our conversation focused primarily on Al Pinkston. Near the end of that conversation, Hugh said to me, "I almost hate to mention this guy to you, but have you heard of Conk Merriweather?" I said I hadn't. And then he went on to describe Merriweather as the sorriest human being he ever saw, but also the greatest minor league hitter that he had ever seen. That got my curiosity. I wanted to know more about Conk Merriweather. So I started digging into Conk Merriweather's background, and that led me to Crowley. Initially, I thought I would write about some about Conk and then a little bit about Crowley in a chapter in Left on Base in the Bush Leagues. But I soon realized there was a lot more to this story than Conk Merriweather, and certainly a lot more than I could fit into a chapter. So that's how it started. And every corner that I would turn, there would be a new story. And it was fascinating. In fact, at one point, someone said to me, told me the phrase, "All roads lead through Crowley." And, of course, that was first used in a newspaper story in 1921 when Babe Ruth and the Yankees visited. John F. Kennedy and Jackie visited Crowley in 1959. That was before he declared he was running for president. Two of the local officials there in Crowley, one was Edwin Edwards. He was a lawyer. He went on to become a four-time governor in Louisiana. And then there was a judge, the youngest judge in the country, by the way, named Edmund Reggie. And his daughter would later marry Ted Kennedy. Her name was Victoria. So Crowley was politically very well positioned for JFK's visit. And when he came in 1959, 90,000 people jammed this little town to hear JFK and Jackie speak. And Jack promised to eat rice the rest of his life, and Jackie gave her speech in all in French. She stole the show.
Yes, and you mentioned at some point during the course of your book that Crawley, Louisiana, was the self-proclaimed rice capital of the world.
Right, and the players turned that around to say it was a nice capital of the world. The two had a love affair with each other. The players were the heroes of the residents of Crawley and Acadia Parish, and of course they were showered with attention by the locals. They got chocolates and free haircuts. They were invited to cookouts. They were family. And that was part of this community pride that the players had, not only in Crowley, but the fans had in their team, the Millers.
So one of the really intriguing things about the story of the Crawley Millers is about this, you know, scenario that you kind of describe as if you build it, they will come. Shades of the Field of Dreams, of course, when Miller Stadium is built in 1948. And of course, 2 years later, minor league baseball indeed comes to Crawley. Ahead of that, ahead of the construction then of that stadium, what kind of baseball, if any, was played in the community of Crawley, and what precipitated this hunger to have minor league baseball come to the community?
They had a semi-pro team, also called the Millers, and they were quite successful, very competitive. But all around Crawley were neighboring towns with professional teams. There were the Rain Ricebirds, there were the Abbeville Athletics, there was the New Iberia team that was initially known as the Cardinals and later the Pelicans. So Crawley was surrounded by towns in some cases that were smaller than they were that had professional teams. So the competitive nature of the community was, hey, we want a pro team ourselves. And they got shut out, of course, prior to 1950 because they didn't have a ballpark. And they built the one in 48 thinking that they would be able to squeeze into the Evangeline. That was their goal, was to be in a league with other Louisiana teams. When they finally got a pro team in 1950, that league was mostly Texas teams. So in 51, when there was an opening in the Evangeline League, they quickly jumped into that circuit.
So tell us about this stadium and the story of its construction and the primary mover and shaker behind this.
It's an amazing story. It was, of course, the community center at that time. Three straight years, Crowley topped 100,000 in attendance, and that was amazing for a town of 12,700. In 1952, the attendance was almost 120,000, and somebody did the math and said that was the equivalent of the New York Yankees drawing 80 million fans. So They were breaking attendance records. They were kind of the poster child for the minor leagues at that time. And their popularity was during a time where the rest of the minor leagues were starting to suffer. The teams were disappearing. Leagues were going broke. And some of that was because of the emergence of television and air conditioning. Crowley didn't have either television or air conditioning until about 1954, and that's when attendance started to fall for them. But the ballpark, what's amazing about that, it was the league and the ballpark. Well, 1957, Hurricane Audrey blew through Crowley and pretty much tore down the stadium. They continued to use it as a ballpark until 1998, but it was pretty dilapidated at that time when a man named Richard Pizzolatto, who remembered going to the games as a kid, was saddened by what had happened to the ballpark. He was now a recreation director. So he led a drive to restore the ballpark, and they did that. And then they started to have these reunions where all the old ballplayers started to come back. For 10 years, they had ballplayers coming to town. They were in their 70s and their 80s, and they were coming to Crowley to relive their playing days as Crowley Miller ballplayers. And so that led up to the pandemic. And the city has invested $5 million to upgrade the ballpark again. It's got an artificial surface. It's a beautiful ballpark, far more beautiful even than it was in 1948. So I think it demonstrates the passion that the Crowley people have for baseball and also their dedication to keeping that ballpark alive, keeping the legacy of that ballpark alive.
Hmm. Explain their efforts to secure a minor league team and how a couple of their initial efforts came short.
Well, one of the problems after World War II were building supplies, and some people were able to get what they needed to build what they wanted. In the case of Crowley, there was a shortage of supplies to build the stadium in a more timely fashion, so they were delayed in doing that. There might have been some other issues, but I think the stadium was the biggest reason they couldn't get a team sooner. But, of course, when they did, they took off. In 1950, they didn't top 100,000 attendance, but they came very close. And, of course, the winning teams helped. You know, they brought in a manager named Johnny George. Nobody knew who he was. He was aptly described in the beginning as a mystery man. And that fit all the way through the end. He left Crowley after winning the second straight pennant in 1952, and he wanted his own team. He went to Dublin, Georgia. It didn't work out there. He wound up in Tallahassee, Florida. He brought in Conk Merriweather while he was there, and that turned out to be his last managing job because, in effect, he conned the baseball people in Tallahassee into thinking he had the financial wherewithal to operate the team. He did not. They got off to a 2-21 start. He was fired. And then 2 years later, in 1956, at the age of 36, he dies of a heart attack in a Birmingham jail awaiting trial on embezzlement. You can't make this stuff up, Greg.
There are some colorful characters in this, that's for sure. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Galen H. White. We're talking about his most recent book, which is called The Best Little Baseball Town in the World. It focuses on the community of Crawley, Louisiana, population approximately 12,000 at this point in time. We're talking about right around 1950, when they landed a minor league team and enjoyed spectacular success over the course of several different years, easily among the most successful minor league teams of that era. Clarify one thing, if you would, the difference between the Gulf Coast League and the Evangeline League, because there's a little shift there in terms of the sort of team that Crawley actually ends up having, and what kind of a difference did it mean to move from one to the other?
World of difference. The Gulf Coast League was established at a time where the minors were starting to struggle already, and so it financially was on shaky grounds when it started up. The teams were spread out through Louisiana and Texas, so the traveling part affected the teams financially, and also the fan interest wasn't there. The in Louisiana, where you had all these teams, this base of teams that had been in the Evangeline League for years, that's where Crowley wanted to be. They wanted to be in there mixing it up with the nearby towns such as New Iberia, Lafayette, Louisiana, Lake Charles, Louisiana. So all it became an obsession to be part of that league. And so when they got into the Evangeline League, it was like they were finally accepted. I think 50 was a breakthrough because they had a minor league team. The 51 was really a big deal because now they were in this league that at one time was known as the biggest little league in the minors. And that was because of so many players that came out of there prior to the war.
Hmm. One thing you tell us about player manager Johnny George, you've just touched a little bit on what a colorful character he was and something of a mystery man, as you describe him. At one point in your book, you say Johnny George's strategizing knew no boundaries. And, I mean, it is safe to say that he had a whole lot to do with the exceptional success of this team. What kind of a player manager was he, and what about his strategizing was so out of the ordinary?
Well, he was moving players around during a game to get an advantage. For example, he had a first baseman named Emil Shiloh who could also pitch very effectively. So he would move Shiloh from first base to pitching to just face one or two batters. Then he'd put him back at first base. He moved other position players around, moved pitchers to the outfield. This was before that was common. He also shifted players in a way that they never did at that time. He just did a lot of things that were kind of out of the ordinary, and he was very successful doing it. He had a temper. And that temper, of course, was something a lot of the players talked about. He had no qualms about taking advantage of certain things. He would sometimes go from catching. He was a catcher. But he would sometimes put himself in his pitcher. And one player noticed that after Johnny would pitch a few pitches, that he would be actually a foot closer to home plate. He'd find a way to get closer to home plate. And when he was catching, they had a pitcher named Oscar One-Eye Johnson. And so he would tell the batters, he would remind the batters that Oscar only had one eye. And sometimes he didn't know where the ball was going. So he would use every trick he had to gain an advantage on the opponent.
We have already touched on just how incredibly successful the Crawley Millers were under the leadership of Johnny George. But we've also touched on an event which occurred in the summer of 1951 that had the effect of kind of stopping the team in its tracks. And it was an on-field tragedy, and just about as dramatic a tragedy as one could imagine occurring in the course of a baseball game. And we're talking, of course, about what happened to outfielder Andy Strong. And you devote an entire chapter to this, and I think do a wonderful job of sort of creating a sense of us being there. Tell our listeners more about this dramatic and tragic moment and its lasting impact on the team.
It's the most compelling chapter in the book, in my opinion, Greg. And it's that because the storyteller, the focal point, is the announcer who called the game and announced lightning has hit this ballpark, and then went on to describe eventually Andy Strong's death. Ed Keim was his name. He grew up in the shadow of Wrigley Field. He'd always wanted to be an announcer. And 1951 was his first year as an announcer. He was known as the voice of the Crawley Millers. And he had fought in the Battle of the Bulge. So in the chapter, he relates after years after this incident, he came to connect two incidents, one that had happened during the war, and then, of course, the Andy Strong incident. And Ed was of the opinion that Andy Strong had a premonition of what was going to happen. And he recounts what took place earlier in the day at the hotel where they were staying at, and also a couple of conversations they had in the dugout before the game. Andy Strong's family, his wife and six-month-old son, the next day, by the way, was Father's Day. He was to pick them up, drive about near the Shreveport area from Alexandria. It was around an 80-mile drive, and then drive them to Crawley to stay for the rest of the season. Of course, he never made it. But Ed's ability to, well, first off, Ed said right off that he had never forgotten it, and he could recount everything like it was yesterday. So Ed was 90-something at the time when I interviewed him. He passed away, unfortunately, just a couple years ago. But through Ed's eyes, we see what happened that night in Alexandria, Louisiana, and it is a tremendous story. And, you know, it happens to be this is the 70th anniversary of that. Next month, around Father's Day, will be the 70th anniversary of that. And I want to mention this. In Crowley, just this past week, a 17-year-old Notre Dame High School student was murdered in his car. And the city right now is going through, you might imagine, dealing with this tragedy. And I was just thinking how the city dealt with the tragedy of Andy Strong. Right after he was killed by lightning, 2,000 fans packed Miller Stadium. They raised $5,000. That's $51,000 in today's dollars for the widow and her six-month-old son. So I think the city of Crowley, that galvanized the city of Crowley, and I'm hoping that the same thing happens now with the tragedy that has most recently happened in Crowley. Hmm.
Yeah, it's inspiring to read about how the community rallies around this young family in the wake of this tragedy, and also the fact that the Crowley Millers, although somebody says this incident really took the fight out of everyone, and the team kind of goes into a bit of a tailspin, but they eventually recover and go on to amazing greatness. And one of the biggest reasons for that is this dynamic, talented, but erratic player named Conk Merriweather. We've already mentioned him, but maybe say a little bit more about what he brought to this team and what made him such an unforgettable character.
Well, Conk Merriweather was a great hitter. He went to spring training with the Cardinals in 1946. He had started his career as a pitcher, same as Stan Musial, who was part of the Cardinals organization. So when Conk was invited to spring training in 1946, is with the idea that he would be able to make the transition to a position player as Musial did and become another great hitter for the Cardinals. And he was quite successful during spring training. He had a great spring training. They sent him to Houston, their AA farm club. He was hitting .333. Then he just sort of disappears. There was never any news reports as to what happened. He then reappears in Houston, plays a couple more games, and suddenly he's down in Class C. Houston was Class AA and in the Texas League. The only news accounts of what happened at that time, they said that a newspaper in Allentown, where he'd played prior to going to the Cardinals, is that he'd had a nervous breakdown, and he had some health issues as a result of serving in World War II. So that is all we have to go on, other than what Conk Merriweather later told his manager at Tallahassee, a gentleman named Duke Doolittle. And Duke Doolittle recalls in one of the chapters how Conk bemoans the fact that when the Cardinals called him up, they're going to bring him up to the majors, that he was too drunk to get on the train. And as a result, the Cardinals said goodbye to him. So they're kind of conflicting accounts what happened there. I think the in-person account from Duke Doolittle is the one that I go with. But then you also have these stories about the nervous breakdown. Mm.
One of the issues that ultimately comes up is that of the place of black players in Major League Baseball and in a place like Crowley. And could you just say a word about kind of the uneasy situation that we're talking about here?
Well, at that time, of course, segregation was in full force in the South. The black fans had to sit along the right field foul line. They were big supporters of the Millers. Crowley never did have a black player. There were black players in the league. The league was integrated in 1954 by three black Cubans, Tony Taylor being the best known of the group, and he went on to have quite a major league career with the Cubs, the Phillies, and the Tigers. So there weren't any incidents in 1954 anywhere in the league. But in 1956, Baton Rouge, of all places, the state capital and the home of LSU, they had a racial ban at their new ballpark, and that prevented the Lake Charles and Lafayette teams that had black players from playing there. One of the black players for Lake Charles was Philippe Alou. The league never officially said that the racial ban was the reason that these blacks were sent out of the league. One person said that Philippe Alou wasn't good enough. And as you and I both know, he went on to become an outstanding major league player and manager. So the racial ban in 56, while it didn't kill the league, it certainly contributed to its demise in 1957. But the actual end of the league was caused by Hurricane Audrey.
And you describe that in some detail, the terrible damage that was done. And, of course, that comes on the heels of television reaching Crawley, and people begin watching TV rather than seeking out baseball games. And it's kind of a perfect storm, pardon the pun, which lead ultimately to the demise of the team and league. As we're talking about the place of blacks in baseball at this time, and blacks in the community of Crawley, that brings to mind a significant player in the Crawley Miller story. One Emile, is it Chaillot? Is that how he pronounced his name?
Chaillot. The last Y-O would be like yo. His son carefully explained it to me here recently. Yes, Emile Chaillot was a very interesting guy. He was a boyhood friend of Johnny George. They grew up in Mobile, Alabama, and they lived right near the black area of town, and they played with the black players there on the sand lots. In fact, Emile Chaillot remembers playing with Henry Aaron there in Mobile, Alabama. Emile Chaillot was dark complexion, Mediterranean-type look, and so sometimes he played on traveling black teams. He was an interesting guy. He was the most valuable player on the 1950 team. Then he went into the military, suffered some injuries in there, and pretty much ended his career. But when in 1953 came along and Johnny George had resigned to take on this team in Dublin, Georgia, Chaillot applied for the job, and he was one of the three finalists. And he went into the executive board of directors and told them of his plans to bring in players from Mobile, black players from Mobile. He did not get the job. But it could have changed, of course, the face of that league and, of course, the Crawley Millers if he had been successful in doing that. Because everybody who knew Emile Chaillot said he was a ball player first, and he was going to bring in the best ball players, and if they were black, he didn't care. He went on to live in Chaillot and in Crawley the rest of his life. He was a great friend of the black community. He was one among the first to hire blacks in his radio TV shop, and he was became a, quite a legend in Crawley, not only as a baseball player, but as a man who was a friend of all in later years.
Towards the end of the story of the Crawley Millers, as we've already mentioned, a couple of future major leaguers come through and in a sense, get their start there, including a very impressive ball player by the name of George Brunet. Tell us a little bit about what made him extra special as a ball player.
Well, you know, it's interesting that a player like Brunet would pass through Crawley along with Babe Ruth, JFK, and Little Richard, who loved the bus station biscuits at the Greyhound bus station. And, of course, there's a biscuit recipe in the book. You won't find too many baseball books with a biscuit recipe. but George Brunet is probably best known for his appearance in Jim Boughton's book, where there's a conversation that Boughton asks Brunet why he doesn't wear underwear. And he explains that the only time underwear is important is if you're in a car accident. So that kind of identifies Brunet. He was a interesting character. He pitched until age 49, the last 10 years in Mexico. He's in the Mexican League Baseball Hall of Fame. He holds the all-time records for strikeouts in the minors. In the majors, he won 77 games. He pitched for 32 different teams. And it's just to me, and while he was in Crowley, he pitched a no-hitter. He jumped all the way from Class C in 1956 to the majors. And that's at that time, that was a huge jump. Very few players made that. So it just was kind of interesting to me that here of all the players that could come through Crowley and make it to the majors, and he was the first Miller after the war, the first he was first Crowley Miller to make the majors. And it was interesting that it was George Brunette.
Wonderful. Your story, of course, goes on to, as we've already touched on, talk about Hurricane Audrey and other forces that sort of led to the demise of what had been a relatively short but nevertheless period of great glory for the Crawley Millers. And, of course, your story also tells us about the ultimate restoration of Miller Stadium, thanks in large measure to a guy by the name of Richard Pizzolatto, or Coach Piz, as he was known,
right,
who really championed that particular cause. I want to make sure that we have a chance to talk about something that you talk about actually early in the book, and then I think you return to this theme a little bit later, namely the state of minor league baseball in America in the year 2021. When it is trying to recover from the devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic and by some other forces that are also threatening its very existence, or certainly its vitality. Talk first about the pandemic and the way in which this has had such a severe impact on minor league baseball, as I'm sure it has had on major league baseball as well.
Well, the pandemic shut down the minors for an entire year, and then it caused the minors to get off to a late start this year. In May is when they started. It also led to a restructuring. Actually, the restructuring was underway before the pandemic. And at the time that I was finishing the book, it was uncertain how many teams would be cut. Well, in the end, of the 160 teams that they had prior to the pandemic, they've cut 40. Now it's down to 120. They've done away with the Pacific Coast League, which is one of the great leagues, a lot of tradition. In the area I live in, Tennessee, Northeast Tennessee, the Appalachian League, which has produced some great minor league, major league players such as Darryl Strawberry, Kirby Puckett, and others. They've changed that league to now it's a collegiate league. Guys right out of college will be coming in the cities here, and for the first time using wood bats. So quite a difference from what it used to be. What bothers me the most, Greg, about all this is back to my earlier point of when I became a baseball fan. It was through the minor leagues. It was through going to games with my father and seeing the minor leaguers play. And that is where baseball fans are born. Their connections are with usually minor league teams. When I was growing up, there were only 16 major league teams. 11 of those were in 5 cities. So that meant most of the country was feeding off of minor league baseball. And today, with the prices that it costs to go to major league games, I think minor leagues are vitally important to fans being able to see the game, see professionals play it, and take their families. So what they've done through some of these changes and the shrinking of the minors is they're really, I think, affecting the heart and soul of the game. The lifeblood of a fan starts in the beginning when they see these minor league teams play, and that's the lifeblood of the Major League Baseball. And so they're flirting with, I think, some pretty dangerous dynamics. They're affecting the bond that fans have with the game. And as I've told people many times, because I've written about a lot of small towns that no longer have professional baseball, these fans did not turn their back on MLB. MLB has turned their back on them. And I think long-term, that's going to have an effect on baseball.
You write, pro baseball's retreat from small-town America is nearly complete. Do you see any possibility of that turning around? I mean, is there potential for Major League Baseball to sort of stop this retreat and reverse it, or are they going to have to wait for some negative consequences to be suffered before any of this turns around?
Well, prior to the pandemic, they had played a couple of games in Williamsport, where Little League Baseball calls its home. They were planning a game, and I think they are going to play it this year, a game at the Field of Dreams location in Iowa. I think the opportunity is for Major League Baseball to, for some of its regular season games, to, in effect, go back to some of these smaller towns and play games at historic ballparks. That could go a long ways, I think, to rekindling this love affair that small towns had with Major League Baseball. For example, in Elk City, Oklahoma, there's an old ballpark built in 1939. It still stands. It's a beautiful ballpark made out of red rock. And Joe Bauman, the all-time home run king for many years in the minors, boy, he still is. He has 72 home runs at Roswell in 1954, which is the all-time record for home runs in the minors. He played in Elk City as a semi-pro team. He played in this ballpark that, like I say, is still standing. It's in great condition. Why not play one game in Elk City? Go over in Roswell, where Joe Bauman, that ballpark still stands. Play another game there. Visit some of these small towns. Alpine, Texas, which is a great small town. Its ballpark goes back to the 40s, and a lot of your Major League teams used to go through Alpine during the spring and play exhibition games. Go to some of these small towns and play games. You're not going to draw the large crowds any more than you're going to get a large crowd in Dyersburg, Iowa for the Field of Dreams. It's a fact that MLB has a way of re-engaging these small towns in MLB.
The book again is The Best Little Baseball Town in the World, The Crawley Millers and Minor League Baseball in the 1950s, published by Roman and Littlefield, a book which includes plenty of really, really interesting photographs that help bring this story vividly to life. And it does indeed include, in Appendix B, the recipe for bus station biscuits, made so very, very famous in this wonderful little town. The author, Galen H. White. Galen White, thank you so much. Great to talk with you again. Thank you for giving the world yet another great baseball book.
And if I may add one thing, try the biscuits. They're delicious.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Brian Albrecht's monthly visit to the program. He is, of course, the president of Gateway Technical College, and his program is devoted to previewing the commencement exercises that are coming up this weekend at Gateway Technical College, and we'll be finding out about all the ways in which commencement will still happen, but in a way that is safe for everyone involved. President Albrecht's guests with him will include Zena Hayward, who is provost of Gateway, and also the current Gateway student ambassador. Friday's morning show will feature the interviews that were originally scheduled to air today, including a conversation with best-selling novelist Jennifer Weiner. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And if you're interested in hearing a different morning show 7 days a week, including Saturday and Sunday, then subscribe to the podcast version of The Morning Show. It's available on every major podcast provider, including Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Be sure you look for the proper time.